For a couple of generations, Joe DiMaggio symbolized the word class. He was called the Yankee Clipper because he seemed to glide across the baseball field, stately, graceful, and powerful. He set a modern baseball record, getting hits in 56 consecutive games that no other player has approached, and lots of experts say never will. He married a sex symbol, Marilyn Monroe, who quickly jilted him, even as he remained devoted to her through sickness, health, and even death. Yet DiMaggio never appeared to be anxious, troubled, or unruffled. He didn't bare his soul on talk shows and refused millions to write his autobiography. As Paul Simon, who put his name into a song, once said, Joe DiMaggio understood the power of silence. Jerome Charon, the novelist and critic, has written a new book for the Yale University Press's Icons of America series, Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. He joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Scott, for inviting.
You know, you have a phrase appear a couple of times in the book that I think is going to be quoted for years. You say, Joe DiMaggio was like an idiot savant whose magic was born on a baseball field and abandoned him once he left it.
Yes, because it's very hard to find the key to Joe DiMaggio. I mean, Joe really couldn't function away from baseball. That was his language. That was his beauty. That was his grace. And anyone who ever saw him play understood that. I mean, there was complete silence in the field when Joe appeared. Everyone was watching him. And I think that he could not function away from baseball. And that's the sadness of his life.
In fact, you refer to him, I think, after he leaves the game as being a legend without a purpose.
Yes. Well, his purpose was tied up with Marilyn Monroe to some degree. And what most people don't know is that he really rescued her career. That is, she was faltering when they first met. I mean, all these nudie calendars suddenly appeared. And also, she claimed to be an orphan when her mother indeed was in an insane asylum, so that when this was found out, she needed someone to rescue her. So her first date with Joe served as that purpose, and soon they became the prince and princess of America.
Recognizing that they're both gone and we're asking you this question to do that hardest of thing, which is to judge a love from the outside, did they love each other or merely use each other? Did he love her more than she loved him?
I don't think Joe ever used her. I don't think he was capable of that. That was not part of his sensibility. He had a kind of purity, whereas for Marilyn, it was very much a career move. I think she did love him or did grow to love him. The problem was that he was a star descending, and she was suddenly a much bigger star than he was. He behaved very badly in relation to her. He wanted her to become a housewife, and she was very much involved with films and wanted to keep her career, and he never could understand that.
Joe DiMaggio, I believe, was the first ballplayer to earn over $100,000.
Yes.
And Alex Rodriguez gets $100,000 by the time he flosses his teeth in the morning.
Yes, at least.
So when he left baseball, although he'd made a lot of money and didn't fritter it away the way some stars do, he still had to work for a living.
Yes, but we have to remember that he earned, you know, during the memorabilia craze in the 1980s. Now, this is an extraordinary statistic.
This is what I mean. He found ways to cash in on his fame
that
some people found undignified, but what else could he do?
What else could he do? It was better than being Mr. Coffee or being the spokesman for the Bowery Savings Bank. But the sad thing about it is that he could earn in one day signing baseballs and bats than he did in his entire career as a Yankee. So this shows what happened to baseball. It went from being a sport to becoming big business.
Did fans, as we can do, put unrealistic expectations on him?
Oh, we always do. I mean, he was a hero, and we expect, you know, our heroes to remain heroic. But he couldn't do it, you know, after he left baseball. For example, he had this show, the Yankee show, and just to say, hello, this is Joe DiMaggio, he had to have a little card in front of him. He couldn't even read his own lines. He had no language outside his form as a ball player. And that's why he was so spectacular, because you suddenly see a very silent man begin to dance on the field, and there's nothing more beautiful than that.
Jerome Charon, who lives in New York and Paris, his new book in the Icons of America series of the Yale University Press is Joe DiMaggio, The Long Vigil. Well, Mr. Charon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Biologists who study ecosystems typically look at a landscape as a whole to understand how each plant and animal fits in, but they don't generally listen to the landscape. Now a group of scientists is calling for the creation of a new field of study to do just that. NPR's Richard Harris reports they call this new field soundscape ecology.
There's nothing new about studying animal sounds. Biologists have been doing that for centuries. After all, if you want to understand birds like these in Madagascar, you need to understand how they communicate with sound. But Brian Pijanowski is now asking his colleagues to take a huge step back and, metaphorically speaking, listen not just to the trees, but to the forest.
We're trying to understand how sounds can be used as measures of ecosystem health.
He and some colleagues have written a call to action in the journal Bioscience. It's time, they say, to formalize the study of soundscape ecology.
So we're interested in kind of like all the voices of the landscape, not just particular individual species, but really the orchestration of those different sounds by biological organisms.
Pijanowski has a few examples to make his point. Listen to this.
So we're listening to forest elephants at about 3 o'clock in the morning in the middle of the Congo. But we're also hearing some other sounds. The crickets and occasional birds and maybe some other things that are in the background here.
This recording shows, among other things, how animals divide up the soundscape. Insects are monopolizing the high frequencies, and elephants are commanding the low notes. Pijanowski says this sound is just as important to the environment there as the trees and the ponds. Okay, here's another example from his study.
So what we're listening to here is stridulation patterns from ants.
Stridulation is a fancy way of saying that ants are rubbing their body parts together to make sounds that they use to communicate. If you've never heard the sound, it's probably because you've never been buried inside an ant mound.
One of the main points that we're trying to make here is that a soundscape can be something that we humans just don't hear. It can be at a fairly small scale.
One goal of this research is to understand those soundscapes, how animals interact with each other and even across species. For example, some silent newts follow frog sounds to find the best breeding ponds. But one of the biggest questions confronting the field is figuring out how human beings affect the soundscape. Pijanowski made this recording near Purdue University. The high-pitched sound is from a soaring insect eater called a nighthawk.
It's flying overhead, and we hear these a lot in kind of small towns in the Midwest. And so they kind of help give us a sense of place. But we also have a church bell in the background. And that is something that we all kind of like. It's a cultural soundscape. But there are other sounds there that we don't find all that attractive and pleasing.
Like traffic. Those sounds may not be disturbing the nighthawk, but some bird species do poorly when nesting near the thrum of tires. And Jesse Barber at Boise State says scientists have just begun to explore how noise affects animals.
Probably the most telling work has come from a series of groups that have worked in oil and gas fields.
They compared bird life around noisy equipment that compresses natural gas with similar but quiet habitat. In Alberta, Barber says, they found birds had fewer offspring at the noisy sites. Similar results came from the southwestern United States.
The group working in New Mexico found that there's significantly reduced species richness comparing these two sites.
Lab experiments in Germany found that noise interferes with bats that hunt for insects on the ground by listening for the sounds they make when scurrying around. Barber says people just don't think much about how noise is affecting wildlife.
For instance, most land management agencies don't consider noise when they're making decisions about how to manage public resources. And even biologists, on the more basic level, haven't thought about how it's all integrated.
Barber has been part of a project to understand how noise is affecting national parks. He says there's been a huge change in the past few decades, as both vehicle traffic and airplane traffic have just about tripled in the U.S.
For instance, if you record in the backcountry of Yosemite, you'll find that 70% of the time a high-flying jet can be heard on the recording.
He suspects that low rumble is probably not bothering most animals, but still.
Even if it's not affecting wildlife, I would say that 70% of the time occupied by high-flying jets is definitely an influence to human enjoyment of that landscape.
So Barber agrees it's time to study the ecology of sound and find out how it affects people and wildlife alike. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You can hear more sounds of the landscape on our website, npr.org/science. When Richard Burton first took up with his co-star in Cleopatra, he claimed to be astonished at how famous she was. She knocks Khrushchev off the bloody front page. When Elizabeth Taylor, or as many remembrances, including this one, I suppose, couldn't resist putting it, Elizabeth Taylor, Hilton Wilding, Todd Fisher, Burton, Warner Fortensky, died this week at the age of 79, she shared the front page with an earthquake, a nuclear crisis, and rising revolutions. Elizabeth Taylor never lost top billing. She was besieged by paparazzi with sizzling flashbulbs from the time she was a teenager in 1944's National Velvet. She made more than 50 films, won 2 Academy Awards, and wore some of the world's glitziest diamonds, but was wise enough to once tell the New York Times, "I've been lucky all my life. Everything was handed to me. Looks, fame, wealth, honors, love. I rarely had to fight for anything, but I've paid for that luck with disasters." Her third husband, Mike Todd, one of the 2 of the 7 husbands whom she truly loved, she volunteered to interviewers, died in a plane crash just before Elizabeth Taylor gave birth to their daughter. The man she married twice, Richard Burton, drank, hounded around, and threatened to drag her down, too. She had heart operations, a brain tumor, a tracheotomy, a hysterectomy, pneumonia, deep depressions, and a double hip replacement. "When they knock you out," she once told writer Marjorie Rosen, "it gives you time to catch up on your beauty sleep." She suffered a lot of self-inflicted disasters, too, problems with drink and drugs, for which she was bold enough to seek help in the public eye. Elizabeth Taylor's real life, not the one on film reels, reminded people that beauty and money sometimes buy a lot of heartache, too. In later years, the elegantly dark beauty with spectacularly violet eyes that smoldered and capped in a hot tin roof and made the yellow rose of Texas wilt in Giant put on weight. And she gained stature. She learned about the toll of AIDS when she saw so many of the people who helped her make movies die. In the 1980s, she was one of the first people to speak out for those who were sick with a disease that still carried a stigma. Everyone was running for cover, Jack Larson, the actor and composer, told Biography magazine. And then Elizabeth Taylor came out of the woodwork and put her great heterosexual reputation and beauty on the line. She turned the public perception of AIDS around. Elizabeth Taylor left the screen and became a star who shined light on something that needed to be seen.